I never had any problems. I had a really great childhood growing up and until primary seven. And that's when I'm convinced that I didn't have a sexuality before then. Because it was at that time in primary seven that I started to identify that I was different and that I didn't fit in, particularly with the other girls in my year.
And what do you mean by that, didn't fit in?
Well, I mean, they would have been talking about their boyfriends and they'd have been fancying celebrities, and I was having dreams about girls and, you know, all of that sort of hormones that were kicking in at that age. And I wasn't the same. So anything that they were expressing, I felt that I had. I felt compelled to fit into them. And I felt compelled to try and fit into or conform at least to society's view of normal.
And so you were pretending. And yeah. With that pretending comes a lot of pressure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, in year seven, primary seven, P7, you don't really know what sexuality is, do you? So
no.
you just knew you were different in some way. And
absolutely,
it was confusing.
Yeah. Yeah, it really was. I mean, I couldn't quite understand what it was that was wrong with me. And it was only when my dad came out and explained to me. I mean, obviously, my parents had separated whenever I was seven. So by the time I was getting into secondary education, that he had sat me down and told me the reasons why him and my mum had actually separated.
And your dad, how did he tell you? What did he say?
Well, he told me that his partner that he was living with at that time, or who I assumed was his friend, and what we had led to believe his housemate was actually his partner. And he had explained to me, but...
How old were you when he said this?
11. Thing? 11, 12. In
how did that go down
12,
your head? Your dad's gay.
To be honest, it went down one ear and out the other initially until I had a look online and when I Googled that and the screen filled with all of these images. And I mean, I go into detail in the blog where I say about me growing up and having these aspirations to be just like a Disney character with marrying my own Prince Charming and having my own football team of kids. And my mum had married her Prince Charming and then he had left her to go and be gay. So at that time I carried the crucifix. I felt like, you know, that this disease had ruined my mum's life. You know, her Prince Charming had let her down because of this disease, and that was what I'd carried through. So
you hated gay?
Yeah.
The concept of gay?
Absolutely. I hated myself more than I hated my dad or hated the situation or hated gay. I just hated myself because whenever I'd Googled the images online and the screen filled with all these images, and for me I felt like that was my diagnosis. You know, the more that I looked into it, it felt like that was what was wrong with me, and then I felt like it was my fault.
And you knew by that stage, yeah, when your dad had come out to you, you knew you were gay, did
yeah.
you?
No, not at that point. Whenever he came okay. out, I knew that I was different, mm-hmm. but it was only whenever I went online and researched what gay was that I felt that I'd made a self-diagnosis, that I knew.
Let's talk more about then what happened with you, because... So your dad came out to you, we've heard that, and you're working out for yourself what you are. And the pressure's building, presumably,
yeah.
with you as an individual, because you can't be yourself. How did that pressure manifest itself?
I was in a technology class, and I remember some of the boys that had been joking around and had said about, you know, faggot, gay, poof.
Just calling you this? Or?
No, just in a general conversation. I never had anything like that directed at me in secondary school because I didn't come out in secondary school. It was when I was moving into tech that I finally came out. But whenever I was in that technology class, I'd heard all these words going on in the background, and before I knew it, the teacher had come into the room and I'd burnt my hand, and I didn't realise until the teacher had come into the room, but it seemed to be calming me down, and I felt this rush of, like, blood run into my head, and it was just as if it completely annihilated anyone or anything around me. So I turned to self-harm. When I felt angry, that was how I calmed myself down and how I took away the pain.
So you were cutting yourself?
Yep.
How did people not notice?
Well, people didn't notice because I'd done it on the top of my arms and the top of my thighs. I was careful to do it in places that people wouldn't see. But one time at a sleepover, this was a number of months, maybe a year later, I was at a sleepover with a friend. And a friend seen them when I was getting changed, and she questioned me on it, and I'd said that it was the cat, and obviously she wasn't buttoned up the back, you know, and she pushed it further, and we'd had a conversation, and I broke down to her and told her that I was self-harming, and she had threatened to tell my mum, and I couldn't cope with that. I couldn't cope with the idea of my mum knowing that I was self-harming. I mean, in my head at that time, this was a disease that I had and no one knew, and it was a disease that I was coping with, and that disease has already broke her heart. And I'd try and convince my friend if she would just give me enough room that I would come out to my mum eventually, not come out as being gay, but come out and tell her that I was self-harming at that time and that I needed a bit of help. And I tried, but it didn't work. I want to say that I tried. I'd built myself up with a lot of courage that I was going to talk to mum and tell her that I needed help, but couldn't do it.
It must be a very lonely thing, sitting as a child, my goodness, at any age, sitting in a room, mutilating your own body. It's a very lonely, certainly, image I have in my mind.
Yeah, but I suppose so. At that time, I was in control. I had something to be in control of, you know.
But you were hurting yourself.
I was, yeah. And don't get me wrong, for anybody that's listening that does self-harm, I really encourage them to reach out and get help and to speak to someone. Because looking back, I mean, if you've read the blog, it manifests into the point where I tried to commit suicide, and it got worse, it got bigger. And that desire to feel pain got bigger. But
why?
Because I wasn't feeling anything else. I was numb inside.
And did you try to take your own life before you spoke to your mom?
Yes. My friend
had
told
me. Why did it get to that stage?
Well, my friend had said to me that she was going to tell my mom about my self-harm, and I couldn't cope with that. I didn't want my mom to know. And so I told my friend that I would tell my mom in
because you were
time.
Ashamed of her finding out why you were doing it, or what?
Shame because I didn't want to hurt her. My mom was already hurt. You know, this disease had already hurt her. And then here was me going to come out and tell her that her own daughter was hurting herself because she had this same disease.
The disease of being gay.
Yeah.
As you're describing it.
Yeah. That was how I felt at that time.
So you couldn't have your mum finding out?
No. So my friend told me that she was going to tell my mum if I didn't. And so I'd convinced my friend that if she gave me enough space and time, that I would eventually tell mum. But no matter how much I tried or tried to gear myself up with the emotions and the courage to tell her, it didn't come about, and so it resulted in me taking an overdose. I go into detail about it in the blog, but the only thing that reminded me at that point in time that I was conscious was my tears and my mum's tears. And I remember looking at her face and I thought, I can't do this, you know, I don't want to die. I could see that it was hurting her more knowing that I was lying there and what I tried to do. So mum, obviously, she was really upset. A psychiatrist came in and they'd more or less then referred me for counselling services.
And did your mum ask you why you tried to kill yourself?
Yeah, of course. I mean, she asked all those questions. And
what did you say?
Blamed my dad. Blamed it on my dad.
She still didn't tell her?
No, couldn't tell her. So we went counselling, and the whole purpose of the counselling was to help me come to terms with my dad's sexuality. But secretly, it was helping me. And at that time, I didn't really care about a career. I didn't care about money, you know, or what I was going to do. I just wanted out of that situation. I wanted to get away from school, and I knew that this was my opportunity to come out of the closet, so to speak, but to live my life the way I wanted to live it. That transition from school to tech, that entire summer was probably one of the loneliest summers I've ever had, but yet the best summers. I practiced at home. Like other kids would have been out at summer schemes, would have been out playing football or out with their friends, where I was at home dancing around and practicing routines or doing a wee bit of karaoke or something, you know, getting ready for my audition. And I'd practiced in the mirror saying that I liked girls. And when I wrote that in the blog, I cringed. But that was the reality of it. I did. I sat in a practice saying that I liked girls and practicing common eye.
So this is Northern Ireland, 2004. Northern Ireland, 2004, right? Which is very much different than, you know, I work in England, I work here. And, you know, Northern Ireland is still more intolerant to people and their sexuality and different people than elsewhere. So it's even harder living in Northern Ireland.
It is harder, yeah. But I personally think our government and how things have went to Northern Ireland is wrong. I don't think we went about it in the right way. And let me explain that. I'm a bit of a diplomat. One side of the family is extremely religious and the other's not. And I personally believe, I support and endorse true equality. And with true equality, it's not about robbing Peter to pay Paul. It's about giving rights equally across the board. And that includes giving rights to those people who oppose and hold a different, you know, a viewpoint to you. Where I watch TV and some of the things that's on TV, even your show, Stephen, you know, some of it's extremely aggressive. I'm watching that, you know, whenever I watch those sort of programmes, I mean,
that's because politics in this country is aggressive, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But I guess watching it,
I get all the blame now.
As a 26-year-old watching it, you know, you get that oomph and that, you know, go get in. And but as a 14-year-old or even an 11-year-old at that time, if I'd have been watching that show, I'd have stayed in the closet. And I don't mean just your show. I mean watching TV, the news that comes on, the statements that are released. And that's what I'm saying. What brought me about writing this story is back in November, I'd done another research again where I just typed in gay and my statements filled, or sorry, the screen filled with statements of condemnation.
And there are some people feel it's fundamentally wrong. They're entitled to feel like that, aren't they?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's important that we recognise that. As I say, I'm quite a diplomat. I think, you know, there's many heads, many minds. We don't all think alike. But it's essential that our government reflects everybody and the true diversity of Northern Ireland. And so, I think in order to do that, we need state and religion to be separate.
how tolerant or intolerant are we? What's it like for a gay person in Northern Ireland?
Stephen, we always look at the negative, and I find even the stuff that's coming out, there's a long, long way to go for LGBT people in Northern Ireland in terms of reaching true equality, but you just have to look at how far we actually have came. It's been decriminalised. We have an LGBT centre. We're brought in and invited constantly into the City Hall. We're incorporated in anything that's diverse. We can walk the streets without prejudice.
Can you?
Yeah. I mean, well, I can.
Can you?
The Gay Pride Parade can too.
You would feel comfortable, I don't know, holding hands with another woman walking down
Royal
Avenue?
Absolutely.
You don't think you'd get abuse? Mm-hmm.
There may be the odd person that'll maybe throw a look, but it's now moving from tolerance to respect.
I think that's been reflected in our politicians, in our politics. Tolerance? Do you hear much tolerance from politicians?
Yes. And I'm going to be the devil's advocate here, because I know there's a lot of publicity around the DUP and they're seen as the bad guys. Because
I don't see them as the bad guys. I don't see anybody as the bad guys.
No, I don't mean you holding that view, but I mean there would be some in Northern Ireland that would see them as the bad guys or holding things from progressing or moving forward. But I think that it's essential. We need to promote tolerance for a diverse society and recognise that we do live in a diverse society, that there's people who will hold an opposing view and people that support it. And I think it's essential that we use the law of the land to protect each of those diverse opinions and those diverse backgrounds, such as the religious institutions, rather than using the religious institutions to dictate the law of the land.
If we go back then to the story you were telling us at the beginning,
yeah.
How did you tell your mum? And what did you tell her? How did you do that?
Well, I'd had my first experience in tech and I'd became confident in who I was, and I knew at that point then that I was a lesbian, and I felt extremely excited. I was extremely confident in who I was. But there was a sense of guilt. You know, as much as I was equally excited that I had this new lease of life, that everything that I had experienced up till now seemed to disappear. You know, all of those worries seemed to disappear. That I started to look at the scars on my body from the self-harm as something from surviving. You know, that I had survived this and that I'd came out the other end. But I felt this sense of guilt. I mean, I remember waking up the next day, and it was after my first experience. I was so excited. And then I remember just looking at my mum when I went downstairs for breakfast, and I was just looking at her, and the only thing I could see was her face that day in A&E when she was crying. You know, when I seen the tears rolling down her face, and she was sat there, a woman where her daughter had just tried to commit suicide, and she didn't have any answers, you know, but instead she had a load of questions, and she still had them questions that had never been answered. And this was years later, and here's me sitting in front of her having this new lease of life, extremely confident to who I was, but hadn't shared it with her. So I felt extremely guilty. It finally got the better of me. I'd wrote letters, tore them up, wrote some more, tore them up again. And I finally came to the conclusion that I couldn't tell her. Went online and I'd seen this buzzing community in the Republic of Ireland and thought, I'm going to go there. I'm going to go and live there. At least that way I could live my life without any questions, and I wasn't too far away from home in the event that she needed me.
So there's an irony, if there ever was one. This staunch loyalist.
Yep.
Want them to go and live in Ireland.
Yep.
In Dublin, presumably, yeah. And get out of the United Kingdom and get out of Northern Ireland because mm-hmm. you didn't feel you could be accepted in part of the United Kingdom.
Yep.
So you actually packed your bags, didn't you?
I did indeed, yep. And I went and I stood outside the Europa train station at the statue, and I cried my eyes out, and I thought, how can I go get on this train and go to live a life somewhere else when I haven't explored what life would be like here? You know, I needed to tell her. And so I phoned her, you know, as you do when you're in doubt. Or, I mean, my mum and me are so close. She was the first person that I was going to phone, but yet it was about her. The problem was about her. And so I phoned her, and she was at the office, and I told her my intentions. I told her that I was going to go and live in the Republic of Ireland. And she'd asked why on the phone, and told her I couldn't tell her. And I kept saying over and over again, I can't tell you, I can't tell you. And she was like, stay where you are, I'm coming to get you. And at this point, you know, people throwing money at me, thinking that I was begging, you know, outside the statue. You know, with crying and stuff. And my mum eventually came, and as soon as I got into the car, she threw her arms around me, and she was like, I know. And she was like, I know. And she was like, you're gay, aren't you? And instantly everything just lifted, and it was like, well, why have you not said, you know, why have you not talked to me about this?
So at the point at which your mum said to you, I know,
mm-hmm.
that meant the world to you?
Everything. Absolutely everything. It just felt like an entire weight had been lifted. I felt like I belonged. There was a sense of acceptance.
It doesn't sound, I know it makes sense, but it doesn't sound initially like it should make sense, does it? Because you were frightened of your mum finding out, mm-hmm. and therefore when she said, I know, if you follow that logic, you should have been terrified.
Absolutely.
But you
yeah.
weren't.
No, not at all.
It was a relief.
It's the fact that she threw her arms around me in the way
and
that
the
she...
hiding it had gone.
Absolutely, yeah. Everything was gone. The entire weight had been lifted. And I just felt like a sense of belonging again, you know, and I felt like I was accepted. And it made me think about, you know, the self-harm and the attempted suicide. And, you know, and I didn't just attempt suicide once. I attempted it on a regular basis, you know, after that particular incident. And I think just with everything that I put my mum through, it was just a sense of relief for both of us.
You know, I do wonder for those people who, and they are entitled to be, they're entitled to have a view that homosexuality is wrong, mm-hmm. because you're entitled to have those views in any free society. But I do just wonder what they think and how they think when they hear someone like you, you know, a young person with your whole life ahead of you, 26 now, mm-hmm. you know, saying out loud, nearly too effortlessly, that, you know, you tried to kill yourself on many of occasions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do people feel in themselves when they know that they're anti-gay and they hear someone like you saying, yeah, I tried to kill myself so many times because you didn't think in this country, here in Northern Ireland, that you could even be tolerated?
Yeah. It's difficult to guess. I mean, I suppose any sort of right-thinking person would absolutely support anybody that had suicidal thoughts, I would imagine. I guess in terms of the support that they might receive would be different. But as I say, I mean, this is the one thing and the reason why I done the blog is because there is that attitude and there's still that perception that exists in Northern Ireland.
Why did you get into politics?
It was nothing to do with being LGBT. I mean, don't get me wrong, obviously I'm delighted that the LGBT community have an additional representative, but I guess I grew up as an outcast, so I grew up not having anything there and feeling like I never had a sense of belonging. But the one time of year that I always felt that I had a belonging was on the 12th of July, and it was when I was with my family. We were all there for the same purpose, and we just stood watching my granda, my uncles, my cousins walking by, whether it was in a lodge or in a band, and that was the one sense of my identity. It was something that was shared.
Now, hold on a moment, but isn't the 12th of July a celebration which, in having that celebration, reminds another community how they're not tolerated? You know, when you're marching with your drums and your bands and you're wanting to march up into neighbourhoods where you're not wanted.
But they're not walking up into neighbourhoods where they're not wanted.
It's a
whole other argument.
You haven't heard of Ardoin?
I've heard of Ardoin, yeah, family living in it.
Well, therefore, there's a community there thinking, hold on a minute, where's the tolerance for them and their respect?
It is about respect and it is about negotiation, it's about mediation, and that's the thing, Stephen. In regards to the North Belfast, the Orange Order have came to the table on a regular basis. There used to be 5 parades up and down that road, Stephen, and the Orange Order came to negotiations and came to the table to negotiate reducing those, and they've reduced it down to 2, and that's all they want, is 2 parades from 5. But there, you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make a drink.
Because you speak most Saturdays at Camp Tweddle, don't you?
I don't know. I've only done it once.
Oh,
I've
right.
only spoke at Tweddle once, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you're there most weekends?
I am indeed, yeah. I'm there every Saturday.
So you're there most weekends at yep. Camp Tweddle?
Yep.
Do you think it's time to pack up the whatever it
Absolutely
is?
Absolutely not.
The caravan, the bags and go home? You've made your point. How much are you going to cost this community in terms of policing?
Absolutely not, Stephen. I mean, what sort of price can you put on civil rights? What price can you put on human rights? I mean, these are people that feel oppressed, pushed to the pillars and the margins of society.
It's been there for 13 months.
Absolutely, and it'll continue to be here for another 13 months. Something needs done here. I mean, what we're supporting now is a commission of inquiry to be established to see the inequalities that the Protestant community is facing
what
here.
What inequalities?
That's what I'm saying, Stephen. There's 5 parades that the Orange Order usually apply for per year. To walk that stretch, that 6-minute stretch along the Crumlin Road. And they usually apply for 5.
There are hundreds of other parades all over the country.
But we're talking about the Orange Order.
Parades Commission breaches don't help, do they?
Not at all.
And when the Parades Commission are making their determination, they look at whether there have been breaches. And guess what? Yes, there were.
Absolutely, yeah. And there has been breaches and things like that need to be discussed with the Orange Order, with the bandsmen and with the marshals. Things need tightened up and they need shaped up here in order for things to go ahead. But the basic and fundamental issue of this is the rights being stripped to walk that road in a shared space. As I say, there was 5 parades. They've willingly reduced that to 2. So they've handed over 66% of cultural expression and cultural parades per year, so that they're relieving that community of 3. But we're being met with, that's not good enough. We don't want that one. And now we've just been met with, they don't want the other one. So they want it all removed entirely, the five. There's no negotiation, there's dictation, and that's the issue.
Interesting what party you've affiliated yourself with. So fair enough, okay, so you say that you're staunch loyalist and all of that. You
didn't say staunch loyalist, well, I'm a progressive loyalist.
Yeah, you're a loyalist.
Yes.
You've no problem with associating yourself with a party that has links to paramilitaries?
Absolutely not. We're a diverse party representing diverse people.
What do you think of paramilitaries?
Don't necessarily hold an opinion on them. In terms of criminality, I mean, I'd be with many within my party saying that it needs to stop. We need to eradicate anything criminal.
Isn't that what paramilitaries do?
No.
Involve themselves in crime?
I mean, anybody that's within my party, within the Progressive Unionist Party, are there with a common and shared goal. And that is to address the inequalities of the working class society and pull them in line, or sorry, the working class communities and pull them in line with a prospering society. I don't care what background anybody comes from. As long as they have that goal and they're prepared to work for the greater good of the city of Belfast and eradicate the inequalities that are segregating the working class.
I hear that.
Yeah.
I hear that. And I dare say that you'll be communicating with quite a few people from your own community in a really effective way. But, you know... When there are paramilitaries, loyalist paramilitaries, that are still to this day taking protection money from their own communities.
I've absolutely no knowledge of protection money being taken, and if there is, people would need to contact the PSNI.
But can the PUP not do anything about it? Can the PUP not have a word in the ear of some of their mates in the paramilitaries and say, well, do you know what? This has got to stop.
Let's be perfectly honest. I'm going to answer the question, but I'm a wee bit disappointed we're here today to talk about the blog and about suicide and about everything else, and it's come onto this, but I'll answer the question
for you. We're here to talk about everything, aren't we?
Well, if you want to put it that way, but we'll get to your point. You're saying there about the organisation and the affiliation with the PUP. Let's make it clear. Paramilitaries are completely separate. The UVF is a completely separate entity to the PUP. There may be members of that who might be affiliated with a paramilitary organisation in our party. But likewise, we have doctors, Dr. John Kyle. You've got myself, a 26-year-old woman. You have school leavers, you've got postgraduates, you've got people who are community workers and from an educational background, all came together with one purpose, and that is, as I say, to eradicate the inequalities that are segregating the working class community from a prospering society. That is our goal, and we won't be deterred from it. There's a lot of focus in Northern Ireland on the PUP because of their affiliations. It's about bringing us down. There's nothing positive there. And whilst that focuses on us, we'll continue to focus on the people. And that's as much as I'm going to comment on it.
What's it like being a woman in politics? Do you think it's any different than being a man in politics?
That's all you see. I mean, growing up, that's all I seen was men in suits. There wasn't really any sort of women that you could turn to or look to, you know, and within politics. So I feel unequal.
There is a reason why I didn't talk to you about just your sexuality or just your suicide attempts. And it is that I can't remember when I've sat in front of a 26-year-old who sounds as articulate as you in terms of politics.
Thank you.
So I'm not too sure that you should just box yourself into just talking in interviews like this, because it feels to me like, you know, I don't know, many people might be punching the radio at the minute thinking they disagree with anything you say, but that's not the point. It's not for me to judge that, but you are articulate, and you should it'll be really interesting to see just how far you go. You've certainly dealt with me all right, haven't you? You put me in my box.
I think I've held me out.
I'm gonna watch this space with interest about you. I really am.
I don't know whether that's a
let's see. Let's see. Let's okay. see. But thank you for talking to me today.
No problem.